Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction and for the opportunity to preach from this marvelous pulpit. Shabbat Shalom, everyone. A few years ago, a scandalous discovery was made in the Judean desert in Israel. It involved a few fragments of a garment. The place became known as the Bar Kokhba Caves, where a number of documents and also artifacts were discovered. And what was scandalous about this discovery, which was after all just a few fragments of some cloth, was that there was distinct physical evidence that some 1800 years ago, Jews were in the habit of wearing an item of religious clothing involving a mixture of materials. I'm demonstrating right now, I'm modeling such a mixture of materials. Now, why is this scandalous that a Jew might wear a tallit, a traditional Jewish prayer shawl? The reason is that if you read carefully, just a few verses after those verses we heard read so beautifully just a few moments ago, you will see that such a combination of materials is forbidden. According to the Bible, one may not combine different materials. It's one of the most mysterious and least understood aspects of biblical legislation. But there it is. We are told, you shall not put on cloth from a mixture of two kinds of material. And yet, precisely such a mixture becomes the ultimate expression of sanctity. We see it again in the book of Exodus, when amongst the equipment which is prescribed for the priests, a mixture of forbidden garments is prescribed, as if to tell us that in our tradition and indeed in life, that which is most sacred and that which is most profane come very, very close to each other. Some 65 years ago, a girl was taken with her mother to the Ravensbrück concentration camp north of Berlin. She carefully had packed a suitcase of clothes from her home in the ghetto of Lodz, which was being dissolved. But having carefully packed that suitcase, she was shocked and saddened to discover that the suitcase was taken from her and she never saw any of those clothes again. Her mother had encouraged her to wear her cheapest clothes for the journey to save the good stuff for wherever they were going later. And so she found herself with one set of poor clothing. And then she discovered, along with the other women, for this is a women's concentration camp, that the Nazi guards had established a perverse rule. If the women in the camp wished to wear underwear issued by the camp, they had to wear underwear which had been sewn from talitot, from traditional Jewish prayer shawls. And the young girl remembers the conversation amongst her mother and her contemporaries that they would rather go without underwear than somehow to be party to a process by which the greatest sanctity was perverted into the greatest travesty. Another story from 65 years ago. Another young person, a child, younger than our bat mitzvah today. A man called Hugo Grin, a reform rabbi, a graduate of the Hebrew Union College in later years, who came to Britain, where I grew up, and I knew him well there. In his memoir, Hugo Grin tells a story of his childhood experiences in Auschwitz concentration camp with his father. He tells a story of the festival of Chanukah. He tells that his father had decided that they would use some of the ration of margarine which they were given in order to attempt to light a Hanukkah candle. He, the young Hugo, was given the task of extracting some strands of material from a cap in order to make wicks. And some contraption was devised, and there, in the most hellish of circumstances, a bizarre event took place where a number of Jews and indeed non-Jewish prisoners in the camp came together so that the candles of Hanukkah would be lit. Rabbi Grin tells in his memoir of the huge disappointment which overcame him when it became clear that margarine doesn't burn, that the whole experiment had been a waste, and that in the reality of Auschwitz concentration camp, to give up on a portion of margarine may have been equal to giving up on life itself. Angry, furious, frustrated, confused, Hugo turned to his father and accused him of having endangered their very life for this bizarre gesture of Jewish tradition. Hugo writes, "It was at that moment that my father taught me a message that I have never forgotten. Hugo," he said to me, "we have learnt in this place that you can live for 10 days without food, but we cannot live for 3 minutes without hope." 60 years ago, almost to the day, the anthem of a new state was sung in Israel. The anthem HaTikvah, the hope, an expression of hope for a people spread out across the globe, subject to the privations, to the worst excesses and perversities of the 20th century. For the first time, a new anthem of this new, renewed Jewish state. And it is by no means coincidental that the anthem chosen for this state was called HaTikvah, the hope. What does the Hebrew word tikvah mean? What is the etymology of hope? Well, there are two possible understandings of where the word itself may come from. At least we find two interpretations of this word in our exegetical traditions. For some, it is to be linked for a word that we find in the book of Leviticus, the word for a mikveh, for a pool. The word tikvah is linked for the notion of something which is a reservoir. Others suggest a different etymology for the word tikvah that is instead connected to the same word as the word for kav, which means a line or indeed a thread. And we find in the Bible, in the book of Joshua, tikvat chut hashani, the hope of the scarlet thread, which you may recall is left in the window as a sign for secret agents. It's a great story. If you haven't read it recently, I warmly recommend it. Does tikvah, the Hebrew word for hope, does it designate a pool, a reservoir, or does it designate a thin, frayed thread linking us from where we are at the moment to where we may yet be? The answer, of course, is that both are true. That hope designates in our tradition both a source from which we drink, a reservoir providing us with sustenance, a place we come back to for support and succor. And it also designates a thread linking us to a better future, a thin thread which we are encouraged to hang on to and not to let go of, however grim our situation appears. It's almost as if this combination of the pool and the linear principle makes hope like a plant, rooted in a soil, irrigated by sources, and yet aspiring upwards, moving on into the future. Now, planting has always designated hope in our tradition. We read in this week's portion that when we are to come into the land, the first thing we will do is plant. And throughout the Bible and later in rabbinic tradition, the act of planting comes to represent the quintessential expression of hope. I may not even live to see the result of my planting, but confident in the source, in the land in which I plant, and confident in the possibility of a future, I plant not even for myself, but for those who come after me. In a way, the two dimensions of hope, the source, the mikveh, the pool, and on the other hand, the line reaching up. This is parallel to the polarity or the distinction between space and time. As I plant for the future, I plant in a particular place, and then I invest in time. I believe in the possibility of something moving forward, of something unfolding. Abraham Joshua Heschel, a man who I spoke about and taught about earlier in the beginning of this weekend, believed that in order for Jewish life to flourish, we needed to be less obsessed by issues of space, by things in the dimension of space, and more passionate, more interested in the dimension of time. In contrast, perhaps, the builders of Israel were emphasizing more and more our rootedness, our being connected to a particular place. Ultimately, of course, we don't need to choose between space and time, but rather we are encouraged to build lives which are deeply connected both to the dimension of space and to the dimension of time. When you come to the land, v'chi tavou el ha'aretz, so we read in this week's portion, you plant. And I want to tell you that planting a tree requires a lot of patience. In preparing for these remarks, I did more research about tree planting than I've ever done before, which is actually not saying very much. I discovered, for example, that a mature beech tree takes some 60 years to come to maturity. And if that's what it takes for a beech tree, we shouldn't be surprised if the growth and maturity of the foundling, of the sapling state of Israel, may not all be complete in 60 years. It takes a long time for the institutions of state, for the social contract, for the civic code, for the written and unwritten constitution to mature and take shape. I want to encourage each and every one of you not to turn away, not to be disinterested or apathetic, about the extraordinary adventure of planting, which is taking place at the moment in the land, in the soil of Israel, in the state of Israel. Like any act of planting, there are a lot of errant leaves and crooked branches. There are a lot of errors and lots of problems. But beyond any of these, I want to suggest to you, the state of Israel represents a metaphor for hope, an expression of what it means to come out from the darkest places of human history and move in to a place of dignity and creativity and hope. We mark in these days, days of space and of time. We mark on this very day a new moon. Time is constantly regenerating and renewing. But also in these days, positioned as they are between Holocaust Memorial Day and the day Israel's Day of Independence, we are encouraged to think about a place, our space on the map. When you come to the land, so the Bible tells us this week, you plant, you root yourself in a place, and you build a hope for the future. I hope that this morning's Bat Mitzvah, who read so beautifully, will know in the course of her life how to live fully, both in the dimension of time and in the dimension of space. And you're invited to come to Jerusalem anytime you like and see how that plays out. I hope that on this 60th anniversary of the State of Israel, even as we acknowledge how much is yet to be achieved, we may stand tall and sing HaTikvah, sing of a hope for a successful planting, a successful combination of space and time. The young girl who was confronted with the gruesome choice in the Ravensbrück concentration camp never forgot that experience. She survived, one of a very few number of children to have survived both the ghetto of Łódź, of Lodz, and then the camp of Ravensbrück. She took the threads of the experience that she had had in those days as an 8 and 9 year old child, and she decided to try and weave from those threads, out of the very depths of profanity, an expression of sanctity. And so she decided that since one of her children had moved to the land of Israel and had made a family there, that she would make for each of her children and grandchildren a talit, a prayer shawl, denoting her passage of tikvah, of hope, from the darkest place to a place of rebirth and possibility. My mother, for that is the woman of whom I speak, made this talit for me. Her own personal act of resistance, her own canopy of hope. We are living in days of hope. May we find both the space and the time to weave threads of hope into sacred garments. Shabbat Shalom.